And welcome to the State of Talk podcast, brought to you by the International Society for Conversation Analysis. My name is Sophia Fiedler, and I am a postdoc at the Leibniz Institute for the German Language. And in today's episode, we explore, with two guests, how conversation analysis can help us understand and shape the future of human communication with AI and robots. As I said, I'm joined by two wonderful guests. Saul Albert, senior lecturer in social science and more specifically in social psychology in communication and media at Loughborough University, and Hannah Pelikan, assistant professor at Linköping University specializing in human-robot interaction. Together we'll discuss the role of generative AI in the field of CA, what happens when humans and machines talk or work together, and where this fascinating field is heading. Welcome, Saul and Hannah, and thanks for being here. Let us start with one question on your personal journeys, how you got into Gen AI and human-robot interaction. So could you briefly introduce your research background and how you came to focus on conversation analysis and AI or human-robot interaction and what fascinates you about it?
So I actually have a background in cognitive science first, but then eventually I got my hands on a robot and I did my bachelor thesis studying interaction with a humanoid robot in the lab. And that sort of like never really disappeared, that interest. So even though I had then sort of like moved to a master's that was more technically oriented, kind of interaction technology, kind of as an engineering degree, I then came back to do a PhD in language and culture, focusing on interaction analysis of robots. So the robots have always been with me, and I really enjoy that it's kind of a technology that, because it's mobile and because it's sort of like physically materially present, it kind of provides interesting opportunities and challenges for interaction.
I also have a background in cognitive science. So my PhD was in a computer science department. Mm-hmm. And for my sins, I was a geek at some point. I have not been a geek for a very long time. So I think I was always aware of and willing to interact with computer scientists, cognitive scientists, people who are in fields that EMCA has interacted with for many years, but perhaps not in its kind of central manifestation as a basic science of conversation analysis specifically. So I think I'd encountered the work, especially of Christian Heath and Paul Lough. Computers and Conversation was a volume that I'd read during my cognitive science PhD. And then after actually doing something which had nothing whatsoever to do with that whole world for my PhD, I studied how people talk to each other in a gallery when encountering a particularly abstract and difficult to encounter piece of performance art. So very far from this world. I became interested in how my father, who was a disabled man, he lived in an environment where he had lots of formal and informal care support. And once he began integrating voice assistants into his daily care routine, I was just very interested in that. So he and I began a project looking at how he and his care staff and his family used his connected smart home system to work together. And he was very keen that it be something that we could share, a piece of applied research that might be useful for the designers and users of these systems. And that was how I ended up getting interested once again in computers and cognitive science topics. But yeah, in terms of generative AI and the way in which that's become such a key part of these technologies, that's a much more recent interest, as it is for everybody, because I guess it's only since about November 2022 that we've had these technologies at our fingertips.
So from your perspective, what makes CA specifically a valuable lens for studying interactions with AI or robots? Let's start with robots.
I think it provides a tool, especially in contrast to other methods. And I think both Saul and me maybe see our work also kind of in a wider context of people studying technology and interactions with technology. So I think especially compared to other ways that are often based on certain metrics, typically based on user studies where you ask someone after they interacted with a device, like, what did you think? I think that an EMCA approach really allows looking at the sort of details and the moment by moment interaction. And it allows us a way to really kind of zoom in on the challenges that we have. So if there's sort of emerging problems that people face, and I think especially in this kind of design perspective where we want to see also how could we improve the technology, we're not stuck with this technology, but there's maybe ways to actually change it. Having a method that is interested in trouble is of course great, because then you can unpack those moments in detail and analyze them and feed them back ideally to the people who can then further improve the technology.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think the same is true of an interest in so-called conversational AI, as with robots. So much of the discourse and our awareness of an interest in these technologies is mediated by fiction and by a kind of imaginary or a technical imaginary that is something we've lived with since the 1890s. It's a kind of artifact of the industrial imaginary and then the computational imaginary. And those are so infiltrated through, and so the whole discourse is steeped in those ideas, both for people who produce the technologies and also people who consume them and how we discuss them. They share lots of the confusion and category errors that are there in our approach to language and interaction, which is so often thought of as easily available to anybody who does it or who lives through language and social interaction. It's invisible because it's pervasive. And I think conversation analysis and ethnomethodology offer us a way, kind of in a Wittgensteinian sense or in an ordinary language philosophy sense, to empiricize some of the phenomena that give us a very distinct perspective on these tools that gets away from those category errors and those sort of fundamental misconceptions about what kind of phenomena are we looking at here. So I think it's a very powerful tool and very underappreciated, maybe not a tool, but a whole perspective and a whole set of interests and literatures and interventions that still have a long way to go before they're fully engaged in the mainstream, I would call it, of the of these discourses, especially in applied research and in industry.
Yeah, if they are ever, right? Because they will develop as we do our research. And then the question is it parallel or is one taking over at some point?
Well, I think that is sort of like something, if I can just briefly insert myself there, like I think that is something that we can also rethink. And I think that's sort of like, to me, the tension between EM and CA, that like ethnomethodology maybe provides ways to think about how can we probe interaction and maybe also kind of step in very early in a design process and change, like also an influence how some of this new technology is conceived, while CA maybe has like more the methods to then also perhaps even go so long as to quantify and to say empirically we can show you that it does not work and you need to take a step back. But I think that we have actually in this kind of sort of like in this tension maybe also that we have between EM and CA methods to deal with both sides and to make ourselves relevant.
Let us maybe talk a bit more about AI before we come to human-robot interaction. Do you see Gen AI as simply a new kind of participant in interaction, or how do you see our idea of social action in CA implemented by Gen AI-based technologies? And before you respond, let me give you a short example that makes this question even more relevant to be asked. I read an article by Gary Greenberg in The New Yorker. And Gary Greenberg is a psychiatrist, and he documented the therapy session that he held with ChatGPT as his imaginary patient. And in his article, he quotes the AI patient who says, and I quote, "I am the fantasy of perfect responsiveness, endlessly available, always attentive, never wounded or withholding."
It sounded like it was a bit for me. I think this is a really interesting problem. How should we treat these technologies analytically? Can we bring to bear the apparatus, the analytic infrastructure of conversation analysis, to look at social practices that may involve or implicate technologies that, as Lucy Suchman puts it, travel under the sign of AI? Because I think firstly, we just have to acknowledge that it's a very problematic category and also carries within it a sort of ideological component that needs to be thoroughly challenged before we use it unproblematically. So do we treat them as participants? I think that's a very interesting empirical question. Yeah. And if I look at the examples that I have under my nose, which are people interacting with LLM-based conversational agents, so voice interfaces, then largely we're sharing turn space with these devices, or at least we have constrained turn spaces in environments in which these devices can make sounds. Mm. So to some extent, we can use the turn-taking apparatus or the ways in which it's been used in studies of human-animal interaction or just environmental noise and silence. So parts of the apparatus are there, but in terms of the participant roles, assumptions and inferences that we might assume are there when we look at everyday interaction and practices or evidence practices that we use, such as the next turn proof procedure, I think have to be re-articulated in terms of the specific applications of these technologies in that environment and how people are treating them in those environments. So I still am uncertain actually about that, but I think that there are a range of settings that we could look at which will probably give us quite different answers. And I think that's an ontological and methodological question that probably needs to be somewhere in the method section of every paper that deals with them.
Yeah. You were already referring, Saul, to your research on one of those LLM-based machines. Like, I think it was Google Duplex, right? In your text on conversational action tests with some of your colleagues, I read that, for example, in repair practices, most interactional work is still done by humans, and that's kind of a problematic issue for those applications. However, you also described that, for example, Google's Duplex was able to participate in other initiated self-repair practices. So which aspects of human conversational behavior are still most difficult for AI to replicate? And I read that in the release statement of Duplex, the authors clearly state that, and I quote, it cannot carry out general conversations. So what is it in general conversations that is so complicated? You said that turn-taking kind of works, repair is difficult. What would you say?
I mean, I should qualify when I said that turn-taking kind of works. What I meant there was we can use the analytic apparatus of conversation analysis, which has largely been built on a systemic understanding of turn-taking, to interrogate those situations and to look at them empirically. And I do think that's the case. Whether or not we'd like to say turn-taking is working, are these devices taking turns? What do we think a TRP is in this environment? It's a really difficult question for computer scientists. My colleague Mohamed Umair at Tufts University has just finished his whole PhD on TRP prediction in computational models. And it's not a simple, straightforward one. So, sorry, that's a bit of throat clearing. In terms of what's possible, what's easy, what's difficult, I think when we were talking about conversational action tests, that is myself, William Housley, Liz Stoker and Ryan Sigvaland, we were talking about how do we evaluate the performance of these systems in terms of their ability to participate in interactions. And in that particular case of Google Duplex, obviously it's very task specific, which has always been a way in which modeling of all kinds of tasks has been reduced in terms of the complexity of the interaction. A more task specific interaction or a more task specific problem inevitably is easier to evaluate because you have clear success criteria, or if you're using reinforcement learning, you have fitness functions, or if you're using other computational techniques, you know, it's just much more straightforward. A general conversation, I mean, who even knows what that is? I don't think we really know what that is. We can identify a subset of actions that are available in institutional settings from which we draw this idea that there is a broader pool of everyday conversation. That's a very woolly and ill-defined activity. I think there's a broader category of human sociality that we haven't had enough time in whatever the 70 or 80 years that this work of conversation analysis and ethnomethodological conversation analysis has been going. I don't think that's been fully articulated as a scientific area of study. That's still early stages. So I wouldn't like to say whether we can emulate something that we actually have no real theoretical models or understanding of. And it's very premature to formalize those things, I'd say.
So Hannah, in your work, how have you seen people adapt their conversational practices when interacting with robots or conversational agents?
That started like very early on in my very first study that I did with Matthias Brod here at Linköping, looking at this little humanoid robot Now, and we could see how people adapted the ways in which they designed their turns to the robot when they discovered that they were at that time still very limited in their speech recognition. So they would kind of transition from longer turns. It was sort of like a charade game that we had chosen as a way to like look at how people would speak to the robot. And then we could see how instead of saying, "Are you a monkey?" or something like that, they would then realize that they just kind of had to provide like the keyword monkey. So we could see like very clearly how people relied on strategies that we have from other practices with technology or people who, yeah, like recipients who are kind of in some way limited to adapt to be heard. But in my more recent work, I also found that not only sort of like on the verbal level, but also, of course, with the body. So we saw, for instance, with the work that I did with Stuart Reeves and Marina Cantarotti on food delivery robots, that people in the street who were interacting and encountering these new technologies, of course, also accommodate them and step to the side. And you can see these nice bulges that people make in groups when the robot comes towards them and doesn't quite clear the situation. So they will sort of like nicely bend around the robot. So we can see both verbally and multimodally how people rely on practices that we have. Like I would like to highlight that it's not always like problematic, but we can see how people adapt and accommodate robots.
You have also done work on interactions with, or maybe better, around surgical robots, and you write on your webpage that these robots, when they are helping in a surgery, and I quote, "induce cognitive and affective distance." So how may this change professional interaction longitudinally? Like, do you think that if people continuously work with those kind of robots, this may alter human-human interaction because you get so used to this robot being there that the whole configuration of a surgery changes over time?
Yeah, that is work that I did at Cornell University with Malte Jung and Steve Jackson and Amy Cheadle. So it is a bit more video ethnographic, I would say, but we followed and compared also how surgeons were operating sort of in a kind of open surgery setting and then through a teleoperated robot. And we definitely saw that they had already over like years of practice adjusted the way in which they cooperate in the surgical room. So again, you can see this as a sort of like doomsday, like technology is changing how we interact. But then actually, I think conversational analysis has documented for a long time, and we've seen this in the early work on telephone conversations that has now recently been reevaluated and shown sort of like how these practices have changed from the sort of like phone rings that are anonymous in a way, but then maybe can be heard as a kind of expected call, an expected summons by a caller that we know is going to call us at a certain time, to technology that is showing us like who is calling. And here we have a technology that is sort of designed for the surgeon potentially to be removed from the surgical site and to sit in a different location. Of course, that is affecting the way that people collaborate, the way that they talk to each other. So that was sort of work that I'd looked at in my master thesis in more detail, how they actually design their turns and their requests in a totally different way that is resembling radio conversation. And I think that is something that of course is happening, and that I think we can kind of follow and discuss, and where we should contribute, as we were sort of discussing at the beginning of this podcast also, how can a CA perspective inform our ways of thinking about human sociality and technology in that? Because I think we can show that it's kind of practices that we have been engaging in with different technologies, but we can also maybe criticize, and in this case show, well, what is the underlying metaphor for this teleoperation setting? And in a surgical setting where people are doing teamwork and the work is supposed to be done in the best way to benefit the patient, why are we inserting a setting that would be designed for operating surgeons in a field site or maybe on Mars? So I think that is something that we can question through our methods, and maybe then discuss. Like, there was a recent, relatively recent article by Jonas Iverson on trust in interaction with, more sort of like voice-based agents, but how that kind of like talking to machines can affect our trust to other humans. And I think that is something that we then rather maybe have to kind of ask as an implication for how do we see human interaction, human coordination, human collaboration in the light of these technological interactions, which I would claim are always different from the human-human. We're emulating the human-human, but we're never really getting there. But if we kind of on the surface as a society develop this language that suggests that we would be at the same level, then of course we risk that we devalue human work and human efforts. And I think that is sort of like where it becomes problematic, and where also my more recent work is trying to contribute and to map the work that is easily dismissed, or especially by technologists who are developing robots. For instance, this sort of like accommodation and adjusting to the fine details. The people who kind of are in the loop to do that are often hidden. So that's something that we've also been trying to uncover through our detailed analysis.
Well, it's interesting what you say, because we're always moving towards all of these ethical dimensions that are, of course, related to AI and human robot interaction. And I think that the key word that you said was trust, because again, in this article that I read on this therapy with ChatGPT, one of the big questions was, well, aren't these systems built so that we trust them? And then once we trust them, how do we know if they're still acting in our favor or not? Because there's this empathy that we see and that they mirror, but then we don't really know. Well, there is no empathy, but we see ourselves in these systems. So, and these agents. So, what ethical concerns do you, both of you, see, or what do you see? Which concerns do you see arise when conversational AI becomes more human-like, or maybe too human-like? And wouldn't it be less ethically problematic if conversational AI just didn't become too human, so that we can still make the difference and we can still see, well, this is a robot I'm talking to, and this is a human I'm talking to?
Yeah, I mean, I think Stuart Reeves makes this point very, very convincingly in a number of places, where he says that we shouldn't be analyzing the talk produced by such devices as we do human sociality in various forms. And I think you can extend that to say that approach to analysis, given that we are always trying, I guess, to adopt an endogenous approach as researchers, it makes sense to extend that also to the participants. It makes sense in a way for those interactions to have a different category that's acknowledged. And I think in many cases it does. I mean, if I look at my participants interacting with simpler kinds of systems like Alexa, all these more complicated LLM-based voice interfaces and care systems, there's never any confusion as to whether these are devices that have the same or equivalent capabilities as interlocutors of other kinds. And you see this, people walk in, walk out, interact in ways that implicate or use the device, talk to, with, about. This is one specific use case, but you can see, for example, that when somebody living with dementia, this is one of the studies that I've worked on with Lauren Hall, who's recently finished her PhD here at Loughborough, She was looking at how did a woman living with dementia alone for most of the time in her home, but with one of these voice interfaces, how she would implicate it into these everyday settings. And sometimes she would be talking ostensibly to herself. We had this kind of Goffmanian self-talk that would sometimes be about or implicating the device as a target of often accusations, complaints, blamings. But then she would use the wake word, Alexa, and then draw it sometimes very incompetently into interactions. So there was, despite the setting and the idea, I think, that's often promoted alongside these things, that once again, it's a kind of mediagenic narrative that we have about robots and virtual assistants, that they are assistants or that they are companions. That category error doesn't seem to happen very much in practice, at least in those settings, I think. And Hannah mentioned Jonas Ivarsson and I think colleagues' paper on trust, that the trust that people have, and I think you see this also in Marc Grelier's work on Leni, which is this spam trap for voice spam that comes through, all of our telephones all the time. The belief that we're talking to another party, having a human interlocutor, is such an enormous component of the convincing nature of these reciprocal relationships that we enter into interactionally, that once you don't have that, by virtue of people simply knowing they've set up the device, there's not this category confusion. So maybe that's something that we don't need to worry so much about. That's my sense. I see a lot of concern in the discourse about this, in the same way that you see a lot of concern about very abstract notions of privacy and data privacy that are important. Obviously, it's important that people aren't misled and that people's data isn't shared in unethical ways. But actually, people, especially in interaction, have many ways that they regulate what they say and what they expose and how they interact with these devices. So I wonder if it's as much of a problem as we think it is, or
I
that it's
think
cracked up to be in the narrative. Sorry, go on, Hannah.
Yeah, no, I agree very much. I think for me, I kind of always get the sense of time will tell in a way that there is a lot of hype, and that of course is created also by the technology companies. And I think we have to acknowledge that, of course, in order to create the attention to build these systems that are very complex and costly, companies have an incentive to overpromise. But then over time, and I think again and again, we've seen how people then learn to interact with and treat these machines as machines. There is this sort of like initial question, I think, in Garfinkel's definition of the notion of the member. I think Garfinkel and Sacks describe it as a sort of a person being heard talking a natural language. And I think that is sort of like the challenge here, the crux of this sort of problem, that in the first moment we don't know, and then we have to discover what can it actually do. And over time, we keep discovering, oh, it's actually not that smart. And when we read the literature on early explorations of EMCA into systems design and human computer interaction, some of it, at least for me as a sort of digital native, some of these ideas seem totally removed from how we now look at a computer. I don't have a conversation when I click on a file, but of course, at the time it was new, and there was this like maybe also hope or dream, like, yes, it is turn taking if I click on something and then it opens and it's a kind of a sort of response in a way. But of course, nowadays we would not get the idea to think of a file system in our computer as a kind of participant in an interaction. At least that's how I feel like where participants would be probably very, very reserved to do that. And I think that's what we can see. And I feel like that's why it's important also to keep maybe returning to certain technologies and to sort of reevaluate, okay, there was a hype. We kind of can then come in and empirically follow how people learn and develop practices to interact with technology. But I feel I'm also more, critical towards this sort of, I think it's a hype, basically.
So you're both on the optimistic side.
I don't know about optimistic. I'd say skeptical about hype that in one way or another does serve the narratives promoted by the companies that are investing huge amounts of money in these technologies. I mean, there's this paper quite recently in AI and Society, Eisenman and colleagues wrote, looking at Harold Garfinkel's interactions with Weizenbaum's ELIZA program. And that's so interesting because it kind of shows you that the technology itself is not a major component, or at least the sort of technical implementations are not the major component here. It's the technology of talk, it's the infrastructure of language and social interaction, which we are so innately masterful with, that provides the scaffolding for these technologies to be a part of that process, or a part of those kinds of processes. And I think it's really compelling to look at, especially ELIZA, which was based to some extent on therapy bots. It was based, I think, on Rogerian psychotherapy, you know, the very s simple, in a way, reversal of pronoun use in the response was an attempt to emulate these principles of person-centered psychotherapy. And that kind of unbelies the hype about LLM therapy bots, because you can talk to a stuffed animal, or indeed a real animal, and get great psychotherapeutic outcomes from it. So the technology is a bit of a mystification often, and these kinds of attributions that go along with that mystification. I think, again, one of the real benefits of using EMCA as an approach is that we can maybe get away from those as a starting point for analysis, and look at how do people treat these devices and one another, and share and develop social infrastructures with and including them, rather than necessarily providing them with a sort of subject-object ontology that gets mapped onto speakers and listeners and some kind of default participation framework that we would just uncritically import from other settings.
Yeah, and ideally, I think this is something that I've really been trying to do in my work, especially more recently, trying to find out ways to introduce that approach and that way of thinking to a technical audience. Because I think, and this is sort of like tying back to the companies, like it is extremely difficult to translate our concepts into something that is useful for practitioners. But I don't think that the practitioners don't want to build better systems. So I
Yeah.
think that, yeah, there are definitely ways to work towards that as well.
For me, one big issue that I'm also personally worried about, and also with the CA perspective of studying people who interact with each other, don't you think that because of this, like, increasing trust that we build while interacting with robots or with AI interfaces, that, let's say, in like 50 years' time, when we study human-human interaction, people may have changed their ways in talking to each other. And I don't mean so much like on a structural basis, because I guess that's just, we can't change that, right? But more like on a fuzzy level of empathy, or like what I expect from my co-participant. Because if you get so much used to interacting with someone who won't resist, who won't, like, who will always be available, who is also trained maybe to tell you what you want to hear, and to mirror your own like your own way of talking, let's say, and your ways of interacting with someone. Won't that have an influence? Like, are you so optimistic, or say that's just the hype and it will slow down, that you don't think it will have any influence on how we talk to each other?
I don't think we can foresee the future. And again, like I think one of the reasons why I am sort of skeptical is just because we've seen with different technologies how it takes time to adjust to them and then find new practices. And I think that is something that I've seen in the surgical example, that even though you could come in and say it is different from before, hence it could be bad. I don't think the solution is always that easy, because I think there might also be aspects that
Benefits.
develop in ways that we maybe appreciate. But I think what I would like to say is that maybe with the kind of with technology kind of emulating humans in ways that are on the surface appearing as better and better or closer and closer to humans, there is, of course, a challenge that we really have to be a lot more focused on delineating and scrutinizing. Am I talking to a human or am I talking to a machine? And I think that, as you say, might, of course, have implications that we can't foresee now. I feel that there's maybe always this generational critique of like the young people nowadays don't do X or and so on. So I also can't really tell how that changes. I've definitely noticed that my students happily treat their AI agents as some form of technology to regularly engage with and have written or spoken conversations with. And I think then, of course, we might come to a point where if they sort of treat other people in the exact same way as they're talking to a bot, is that going to affect how we talk to others? So I definitely feel like that is an open question that remains to be seen how it will change. And I think on a kind of, we see, of course, how language is changing, how we kind of come up with new words and new phrases. So of course, it's going to impact the way we speak in that dimension.
Yeah.
But I think it's an open question. It might affect the way that we maybe develop practices for verifying. I think this is like a recommendation for scams already, right? Like have a sort of safe word to share with your family to verify if you get a call by someone who's sort of like very difficult to hear in a setting and talking very quickly and maybe kind of like in a kind of very effectively affected voice. Are they sort of can you have some sort of like shared practice of checking, is this actually my child or my mother who is in trouble? And I think that may be practices that we could see, but then I would kind of wonder, like, is that fundamentally changing human sociality, or is it just another practice that we develop to deal with technology?
Yeah.
So I think in that way I'm not so convinced that it's sort of like just because it's ChatGPT or just because we have generative AI we're going to see big differences. I think that's again like a kind of promise that companies make. And AI has been going in summers, sort of rises and winters, where then society discovers, oh, it's not what we want, what we expected. And I think traditionally there's been a lot of hope in technology for centuries, for ages. Like people have been fascinated by this like artificial human, and I think especially robots are tapping into that area. Like there could be like a fake human that is as good as me. So I think this is like a kind of ancient
fantasy
idea and fantasy that we haven't really gotten there. And I think that sort of just makes me generally skeptical when we hear like, and now we've finally gotten it. And I think we have the methods to also really scrutinize, are we actually there, which maybe other disciplines struggle actually mapping. Is it the same or is it not?
Let's maybe end with one question that does not try to foresee the future, but like a very concrete question. What research questions do you want to address, like in the next few years, or what do you think are research questions that seem urgent to you concerning human-robot interaction or Gen AI more generally?
Well, I think we have a lot of work to do to actually scrutinize these interactions. So I think we are trying to also build a better community within the ethical methodology and conversation analysis, artificial agents or artificial intelligence networks, EMCAI. We have a website where you can sign up for our newsletter, where we announce meetings that we hold usually 6 times a year. So we're trying to kind of build a community where we can share experiences of studying different technologies as technology is evolving and getting more complex. I think there's aspects that seem to be potentially generalizable or practices that we see across different technologies, different robots, different agents, perhaps even sort of like screen avatars and so on. So there are aspects that we can discover that are holding beyond a single technology, because that's often a critique that we would then get, but this is just this robot and now we have a new one that fixes all the problems, right? So I think that is one way where we can actually try to, beyond studying single instances, actually try to build I know that the concept of theory is like heavily debated, but sort of like build concepts that can maybe hold across different settings and where we can describe practices. So that's one big sort of empirical problem that I think we should collectively tackle. And then another aspect where I think we can be, yeah, we can be more courageous actually stepping into conversations with designers. I can only speak maybe for the HRI community primarily, which are people from all kinds of different backgrounds, engineers, psychologists, linguists, sociologists, like people with a very wide as a kind of like area of expertise who are trying to do human robot interaction together. And I think we have a responsibility also as a community to enter those dialogues and accept that they are not always easy and they require a lot of translation work, especially when you're interacting with people who have come from a more positivist stance and they don't understand our way of working immediately and maybe they never will fully understand. But what are ways to actually do things together that are meaningful and where we can bring in a focus on the human, on human practices, on sort of the details of human interaction that are often overlooked or dismissed. I'm having a lot of discussions with people who discover, oh, we should talk about failures and moments that, you know, moments of trouble really, but it's not easy. And we have a lot of literature and we have methods also to do that. So I think that's where I want to come in and also engage in that. So I think research questions really center around both like the empirical side of it and mapping out the challenges with the technology, but then also taking responsibility. Perhaps maybe not everybody has to do that, but I think for some of us, especially with interdisciplinary training, that is an absolute relevant research question to sort of engage with development of methods and seeking conversations with designers to develop concepts that can also inform potentially, I don't want to really say better technology, but more humane technology, maybe. Yeah.
I think from my perspective, the most urgent questions are methodological. They're about how do we draw on this rich tradition of ethnomethodological studies of work, ethnomethodology within human-computer interaction and computer-supported collaborative work, as well as basic and applied conversation analysis. How do we draw on that history and apply it to studying this juggernaut of generative AI that is just so pervasive in all areas of academic and everyday life? It's really important that we try and respond to it in some way, and I think we have a lot to offer. So myself, Elizabeth Stoko, Vika Stommel, and Hendrik Buschmeier just edited this volume of Discourse and Communication on conversation analysis and conversational technologies. And I think we could see, because we had people from industry as well as people from a variety of different ethno and CA traditions come together and offer such a rich variety of approaches. And I think from looking at the responses from our industry colleagues, a very welcome set of approaches. And indeed, Bob Moore, who's been working at IBM as an ethno and CA person for many years, is offering a workshop at ICA in Canada this next year, which is, I think, testament to how important this approach can be for that technological field. So I'm excited about that, and I think it would be really worthwhile to look at expanding all of the approaches that we could make to this area. So some of it will be fairly straightforward. I think the work that I'm doing just takes Shegloff's generic orders of interaction and Jeffersonian transcription and Mondadian transcription and looks at how do people interact with voice technologies and large language models by sharing turn space with them and others. And that, in a way, is like the most simple approach, but it needs qualification and thinking about methodologically, how does this map onto previous work? What other kinds of information or what other kinds of data could we add to that mix? Can we take transcripts of what the machine hears and transcribes itself and add that to our analysis? So those are maybe technical questions, but then more broadly, there's just so many areas in which these technologies are suddenly being applied that I think we need more people to think about more and more diverse ways of approaching it. So I guess I could plug one event or activity which is soon to come with Patrick Dahl, William Housley, and Liz Stokoe, just and Kathy Pearl, who's a conversation designer. We organized a workshop called First Pair Prompt. It's going to go out in the October newsletter. I've written a short blog about it. But the First Pair Prompt workshop was really about generating as many different responses to generative AI, and specifically this interface of kind of prompting through a chat interface, as we could think of. And it was very generative. It was very interesting. So I would just encourage more people to maybe get involved in what we're planning, the second pair prompt, which will happen at some point. We don't know exactly when. And to engage with these technologies, I think it's kind of exciting. So yeah, I hope to read loads more interesting bits of work coming out.
Great. Thank you, Hannah and Saul, for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have ideas or want to participate in the ISCA newsletter or our podcasts and other projects, please go to conversationanalysis.org and reach out to us. We'd love your input in what we're building, which we hope is a truly international connection amongst our EM and CA communities. Our theme music is Ethnomethodology by Peter Daniel off of the album Convulsive Listening.